Hello, this is Jean reading the New York Times for Thursday, July 11, 2024. From the front page, U.S. and allies aim to forge commitments to Ukraine that will endure. By Edward Wong, Julian E. Barnes, and Helene Cooper. The United States and its NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine should have an irreversible path to membership in the alliance, enshrining the phrase in a document that was released on Wednesday during the alliance's summit in Washington. While there is no consensus yet about Ukraine joining NATO, the strengthened language shows that there is movement in that direction. The United States was once deeply skeptical about whether Ukraine was ready to become a member, and while questions remain, more and more American and European officials believe that the country will eventually be able to join. Ukraine's future is in NATO, members said in a communique, adding, "We will continue to support it on its irreversible path to full Euro-Atlantic integration, including NATO membership." The document does not lay out an exact timeline for membership, which the Ukrainians have wanted, but it says the Allies will continue to support Ukraine's progress on democratic and security sector reforms. U.S. and allied officials negotiated the commitments to Ukraine with new urgency, given the uncertainty over whether President Biden, a staunch opponent of Russia in its war, can win re-election this fall, according to officials in Washington. The officials had said it was critical that leaders of the 32 member nations who have gathered in Washington this week used strong language to signal that Ukraine has a viable path to joining the alliance, even if it does not happen immediately because of the war. They also said the leaders must agree to concrete steps to ensure the alliance is the main organizer of military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine rather than the United States. Looming over the conversations is the specter of a second Donald J. Trump presidency. Mr. Trump has expressed admiration for President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, criticized Ukraine, and expressed doubts about sending any additional U.S. military aid to the nation. And in his first term, Mr. Trump talked about withdrawing the United States from NATO. Because of these concerns, officials and analysts said that Trump-proofing the alliance and aid to Ukraine was an important element of the talks this week. "Ukraine can and will stop Putin, especially with our full collective support," Mr. Biden said in a speech on Tuesday night. Beyond solidifying foundations that could endure into a Trump presidency, the leaders are also trying to head off criticism from President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, who last year accused the alliance of waffling on a promise to give his country membership. But a more amicable version of Mr. Zelensky arrived in Washington on Tuesday. He expressed thanks for the support given to Ukraine so far, while prodding the administration to continue relaxing its restrictions on the use of U.S. weapons in Russia and sending immediate aid. "It's time to step out of the shadows to make strong decisions to act and not wait for November," he said in a speech, referring to the U.S. presidential election. "We must be strong and uncompromising altogether." The debate about the communique revolved around whether to say that Ukraine has an irreversible path to NATO membership and what conditions to attach to that. The alliance grants membership only by unanimous consent, and U.S. and other officials have been wary of what Hungary might say. The country's prime minister, Viktor Orban, visited Russia and China before arriving in Washington and is more sympathetic than other NATO leaders to Mr. Putin. U.S. and allied officials say that in any case, a mutual defense clause in the NATO treaty makes it difficult to allow Ukraine in while it is at war. The alliance wants to avoid a direct war with Russia, a nuclear power. Some analysts in Washington who have pushed for greater support for Ukraine said that NATO leaders needed to give the country concrete benchmarks. "Obviously, we need to accelerate Ukraine's path," said Alina Polyakova, the the president of the Center for European Policy Analysis. The problem is we're arguing on the margins over terminology and semantics and not over the bigger strategic objective, which is how to get Ukraine into NATO as quickly as possible. Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, urged top diplomats at an alliance meeting in Prague in May to commit to collectively giving Ukraine 100 billion euros in military aid over the next 5 years. He could not get consensus, but officials agreed to give Ukraine a minimum baseline funding of 40 billion euros within the next year. A multi-year commitment could have helped the alliance prepare for political uncertainty in the United States. But even with a longer-term arrangement, there are no guarantees. When he was president, Mr. Trump withdrew the United States from the Paris Climate Accord and the Iran Nuclear Arms Limits Agreement, which were both negotiated by President Barack Obama. There is another numbers concern. Mr. Trump has often criticized NATO members for not spending more on defense. The Allies agreed in 2014 to spend at least 2% of their economic output, or gross domestic product, on their militaries. At the time, only the United States, Britain, and Greece were meeting the goal. During the 2018 NATO summit, Mr. Trump railed against allies for that failure and then surprised leaders by demanding an increase of the benchmark to 4%, a goal that would have been out of reach for many alliance members. He said the United States would go its own way in 2019 if military spending from other NATO countries did not rise. Mr. Trump so upset NATO leaders that they abandoned plans to hold a 70th anniversary summit the next year in Washington, fearing he would ruin it. Mr. Biden noted in his Tuesday speech that in 2020, when he was elected, only 9 countries had reached the 2% goal. Now, 23 of the 32 member nations will spend at least that. It's remarkable progress, he said. NATO officials intend to highlight that achievement throughout the summit. The best way for NATO to Trump-proof itself is quite simple, said retired Admiral James Stavridis, the former Supreme Allied Commander for Europe. It is for every nation to meet the 2% GDP guideline for defense spending, to which the entire 32 nations have agreed. To guard against any future decline of the United States' role in supporting Ukraine, the alliance is setting up a mission in Germany to coordinate assistance. After Russia's invasion in February 2022, the United States took the lead in organizing military aid. That assistance has been coordinated through the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, which is run by Defense Secretary Lloyd J. Austin III and includes representatives from allied nations. While that group will continue, NATO is setting up a separate office in Germany to coordinate aid of all kinds to Ukraine. The name of the game is to build up deterrence against Russia as strongly as possible in order to withstand a lack of U.S. participation or, worse, attempts at or actual withdrawal, said Evelyn Farkas, a former senior Pentagon official in the Obama administration who is now head of the McCain Institute, a democracy advocacy group. Creating a tighter web between NATO and Asia-Pacific countries allied with the United States, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand also helps hedge against any uncertainty that would arise from a second Trump term, Dr. Farkas said. A U.S. president might find it harder to extricate the United States from commitments and partnerships if NATO and Asia-Pacific allies of the United States spoke with one voice on important issues such as Russia or China. Although Mr. Trump expresses admiration for Xi Jinping, China's leader, he seems willing to appear tougher on China than Russia, such as when he imposed tariffs on some Chinese products. Documents from NATO meetings of recent years have included language criticizing China. European nations have grown more suspicious of China because of its support of Russia. And they increasingly see China's belligerent statements and military actions toward the democratic island of Taiwan as a kind of parallel to Mr. Putin's hostility toward Ukraine. The summit communique said that the People's Republic of China had become a decisive enabler of Russia's war against Ukraine through its so-called No Limits Partnership and its large-scale support for Russia's defense industrial base. It added, the PRC continues to pose systemic challenges to Euro-Atlantic security. Ben Bland, the director of the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House, a London-based research group, said that NATO's toughening language on China and its deepening engagement with four key Asia-Pacific allies of the U.S. reflect broadly shared views about Beijing's assertive behavior and the linkages between security in Europe and Asia. He added, however, there is a spectrum of concern about China among NATO's European members. A minority, such as Hungary, are actively courting deeper ties with Beijing, while heavyweights such as France, Germany, and the U.K. are seeking to de-risk their relationships with Beijing, but still remain reluctant to embrace some of the more confrontational aspects of Washington's China policy. Next, a late play by the Biden campaign, Running Out the Clock, by Adam Nagorny and Jim Rutenberg. President Biden's resistance to pressure to end his re-election bid appears to be a strategy aimed at running out the clock, a play to leave his party so little time to come up with another candidate that his opponents stand down. Every day that Mr. Biden defies pressure to step aside, the prospects and logistics of replacing him become more untenable and riskier. And the potential of weeks of Democratic infighting as a united Republican Party nominates former President Donald J. Trump may start to look worse than rallying behind Mr. Biden, no matter the concerns about the 81-year-old president's health and ability to defeat Mr. Trump. It's a mess, said James Carville, a consultant who has been among a roster of Democrats pushing for Mr. Biden to step aside and clear the way for a new nominee. Suppose he gets what he wants. Everybody gets exhausted and just says it's too much trouble. Mr. Biden's efforts to dig in were showing signs of initial success. On Tuesday, some Democratic leaders in Congress expressed support for the president and said it was time to move on. The urgent need right now is for Democrats to stick together and focus on the danger of Trump and his extremist agenda, said Representative Diana DeJet of Colorado. If we do that, we will win. The calendar is on Mr. Biden's side. In the coming days, attention will turn to Mr. Trump, who is expected to name a running mate before his party gathers next week in Milwaukee to nominate him for a second term. Mr. Biden will be somewhat out of the public spotlight, focusing on behind-the-scenes campaign to keep nervous Democrats in line. There are 35 days between July 18, when Mr. Trump is set to accept his party's nomination in Milwaukee, and August 22, when Mr. Biden is set to accept his party's nomination in Chicago. But the Biden campaign, working with the Democratic National Committee, appears ready to compress the calendar even further. The party is planning a virtual roll call vote weeks before the convention is gaveled to order on August 19, a move that appears meant to leave little to no doubt about who will be on top of the Democratic ticket this November. None of this is binding. The party sets the rules, and the party can change the rules. And Mr. Biden, for all his talk this week of sticking in the race, could change his mind, particularly if another bout of discouraging polls or another performance like the one he had in his debate with Mr. Trump shakes the party's confidence and encourages more Democratic defections. Mr. Biden's show of defiance, portraying himself as standing up against elites, even as polling suggests that most voters believe he is too old to run, may be an act of self-preservation or a sophisticated political maneuver on the part of the president and his political team. But in either event, it has limited the party's options and flexibility should he step aside. It is technically possible, but politically unfeasible, for the Democratic National Committee to vote to replace him if he does not voluntarily decide not to seek re-election. There is no handbook for what a party should do to replace a presumptive nominee after the primary season is finished, how to vet and test potential replacements without the benefit of candidates enduring the voter examination and candidate training that comes with a primary. The ideas being floated require the kind of consensus in the party that gets only more difficult with the attenuated calendar that is emerging. For example, a number of Democrats have called for a series of candidate forums in different parts of the country. That would raise tricky questions that would need to be resolved quickly. Who would serve as the moderator? A former president, such as Barack Obama or Bill Clinton, two frequently mentioned names, or a journalist? Who would be in the audience? And how would the party pick the candidates entitled to get on the stage? There are alternatives, though they might not be that much less fraught. For example, instead of an organized series of sanctioned forums, the candidates could use the time before the convention to travel the country, meeting with state delegations and soliciting support. But that, too, is time-consuming, costly, and complicated, in a way that would give an advantage to the candidate with money and a network. Even the party's high-profile politicians might decide it is not worth the risk, choosing instead to stand back until 2028. A late change at the top of the ticket could advantage one Democrat who has been mentioned as a potential successor, Mr. Biden's Vice President, Kamala Harris. She has the name recognition, financing, and institutional support to step in more easily than any of the other potential successors. There's an understanding that President Biden will be the nominee, said Representative Ro Khanna, a California Democrat. But in the case of unforeseen circumstances and Biden can't run, it will be Kamala Harris. Yet, as the Democrats wander through a world of no good choices, some argue that anointing Ms. Harris is hardly an ideal one. It would short-circuit the kind of competitive process that might allow the party to vet a nominee, and in doing so, minimize the prospect of intra-party strife and the appearance of party bosses choosing a candidate. The scheduling of the virtual roll call is a clear example of how the party is moving to add to the perception of Mr. Biden's perceived inevitability. The Democrats initially made plans to hold the earlier vote because an Ohio law required the party's candidates to be formalized by August 7, or they would forfeit their place on the state's ballot. Ohio officials have since passed a temporary measure moving the deadline to accommodate the timing of the Democratic convention this year. But the DNC, solidly under Mr. Biden's control, says it is sticking to its plans for an early roll call vote to guard against any maneuvers by Ohio Republicans to keep the Democratic presidential candidate off the November ballot. "We're not playing with these people," said Donna Brazile, a former party chair who is now on the party's Rules Committee. But that leaves less time for the party to search for a replacement should Mr. Biden step down. "They should move it later," said Jeff Weaver, a longtime advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders and an advocate for a mini-primary. It is a matter of conjecture among Democrats whether this is a grand strategy by Mr. Biden and his aides, who, it should be noted, have been around Democratic politics long enough to have a thorough appreciation of convention rules and their complexities. The tactics have produced a bit of a public backlash. "Biden is running down the clock," Mehdi Hasan, the former MSNBC host, said in a post on X, which is selfish, it's reckless, but above all else, it's transparent. It also may be working. There is an emerging consensus in the Democratic Party that Biden is going to be the nominee, and we need to turn our attention to making the case against Donald Trump in 2025, Mr. Khanna said. Even Mr. Carville, one of the earliest Democrats to call on Mr. Biden not to seek re-election, seems resigned to that. "You know how bad Chicago is going to be," he said, referring to the convention that awaits his party next month. "We are going to sit Shiva for 4 days." Also from the front page, "In constant battle with insurers, doctors reach for a cudgel, AI," by Teddy Rosenblut. At his rehabilitation medicine practice in Illinois, Dr. Aslan Tariq typically spent 7 hours a week fighting with insurance companies reluctant to pay for his patients' treatments. He often lost. There was the 45-year-old man who spent 5 months in a wheelchair while his insurer denied appeal after appeal for a prosthetic leg. Or the stroke survivor who was re-hospitalized following a fall after his insurer determined his rehab could be done at home. Over the course of Dr. Tariq's 12-year career, these stories had become more common. The list of treatments that needed pre-approval from insurers seemed ever broadening, and the denial seemed ever rising. So, in an effort to spare his patients what he deemed subpar care, and himself mountains of paperwork, Dr. Tariq recently turned to an unlikely tool, generative AI. For a growing number of doctors, AI chatbots, which can draft letters to insurers in seconds, are opening up a new front in the battle to approve costly claims, accomplishing in minutes what years of advocacy and attempts at healthcare reform have not. "We haven't had legislative tools or policymaking tools or anything to fight back," Dr. Tariq said. "This is finally a tool I can use to fight back." Doctors are turning to the technology, even as some of the country's largest insurance companies face class action lawsuits, alleging that they use their own technology to swiftly deny large batches of claims and cut off seriously ill patients from rehabilitation treatment. Some experts fear that the prior authorization process will soon devolve into an AI arms race, in which bots battle bots over insurance coverage. Among doctors, there are few things as universally hated. If you want to see a physician go apoplectic at a cocktail party, mention prior authorizations, said Dr. Robert Wachter, the chair of the medicine department at the University of California, San Francisco. The process was designed by insurance companies to keep healthcare costs down by reining in doctors' use of unnecessary and expensive treatments. But Dr. Jonathan Tward, a radiation oncologist based in Utah, said insurers often demanded so much exhaustive documentation and paperwork, even for standard cancer treatments, that he felt he was on the losing side of a war of attrition. Doctors and their staff spend an average of 12 hours a week submitting prior authorization requests, a process widely considered burdensome and detrimental to patient health, among physicians surveyed by the American Medical Association. With the help of ChatGPT, Dr. Tward now types in a couple of sentences describing the purpose of the letter and the types of scientific studies he wants referenced, and a draft is produced in seconds. Then he can tell the chatbot to make it 4 times longer. "If you're going to put all kinds of barriers up for my patients, then when I fire back, I'm going to make it very time-consuming," he said. Dr. Tariq said Doximity GPT, a HIPAA-compliant version of the chatbot, had halved the time he spent on prior authorizations. Maybe more important, he said, the tool, which draws from his patient's medical records and the insurer's coverage requirements, has made his letters more successful. Since using AI to draft prior authorization requests, he said about 90% of his requests for coverage had been approved by insurers, compared with about 10% before. Generative AI has been particularly useful for doctors at small practices who might not ordinarily have time to appeal an insurer's decision, even if they think their patient's treatment will suffer because of it. Nearly half of doctors surveyed by the AMA said that when they didn't appeal a claim denial, it was at least in part because they didn't have the time or resources for the insurance company's lengthy appeals process. Dr. Michael Albert, an obesity medicine specialist in Oklahoma, said AI had enabled his small, resource-strapped telehealth practice to go from almost never appealing insurance denials to sending 10 to 20 appeals per week. Now, Dr. Albert said he could operate at the same level as companies that have essentially infinite resources. While AI is still primarily used by individual, tech-savvy doctors, a growing number of companies is trying to bring the technology into the mainstream. Epic, one of the largest electronic health record companies in the country, has rolled out a prior authorization tool that uses AI to a small group of physicians, said Derek DeYoung, a developer working on the product. Several major health systems are piloting Doximity GPT, created to help with a number of administrative tasks, including prior authorizations, a company spokeswoman said. But the insurance companies aren't sitting still either. Chris Bond, a spokesman for America's Health Insurance Plans, said insurers welcomed attempts to streamline the process, including those involving the appropriate use of AI. Dr. Jeff Levin-Schertz, a health policy expert at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, said he believed that most health plans were at least evaluating how to use artificial intelligence in their claims review process if they weren't using it already. At the same time, these AI tools may make it easier for ill-intentioned players to bill for medically unnecessary treatments, Dr. Levin-Schertz noted. As doctors use AI to get faster at writing prior authorization letters, Dr. Wachter said he had tremendous confidence that the insurance companies would use AI to get better at denying them. You have automatic conflict, said Dr. Wachter, who wrote a book about digital technology in medicine. Their AI will deny our AI, and we'll go back and forth. Dr. Wachter said he hoped that someday, with more advanced AI technology, insurers and providers could create a new system that relies less on sending letters back and forth and more on automation. Insurance coverage could be automatically approved based on an algorithm's analysis of the most up-to-date scientific literature, for example. An AI tool might also notify a doctor that the $100,000 drug she's about to prescribe could be substituted with a similarly effective $250 pill. Until then, many doctors are enjoying a newfound, if temporary, foothold in the battle over insurance claims. It is definitely an AI race, Dr. Tariq said, but I think it wouldn't be fair if the physicians didn't have AI. Also, after playing an outlaw, Alec Baldwin winds up on trial. By Julia Jacobs and Graham Boley. Prosecutors painted Alec Baldwin as a headstrong actor who repeatedly shirked his duty to maintain gun safety on the set of his film, leading to the shooting death of its cinematographer. The defense argued that it was a tragic accident and that Mr. Baldwin had no reason to believe there was live ammunition in his gun or anywhere on the set of the Western Rust. More than 2 years and 8 months after the gun he was rehearsing with fired a fatal bullet, Mr. Baldwin found himself in a New Mexico courthouse on Wednesday, standing trial on a charge of involuntary manslaughter. If convicted, he faces up to 18 months in prison. That concludes today's reading from the front page of the New York Times. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.